Buenas tardes para ustedes en Ecuador. Good evening, everybody. I'm Francisco Paniza. I'm professor of Latin American politics here. And I will, my main work is to chair this panel, but I have been asked to say a few words about putting the regional context of, about this discussion in Ecuador. And I'll be very, very brief about that because I think the focus of that has to be in, on Ecuador. And I'm not going to talk about Ecuador. And what I'm going to say is that after a long decade that roughly went between 2002, 2003 to 2012, 2013 of unprecedented political and economic stability, in the past 2 years or so, Latin America, perhaps I should focus more on South America, is entering into a process of political realignment and realignment, but as different from the 1990s and the early 2000s, this process cannot be captured by a single catchword that neoliberalists with reference to the 1990s or the so-called pink tide in the first decade of the 2000s, or pinned down to a specific political and economic crisis. So there's no defining crisis that forces certain changes like the debt crisis of the 1980s or the political and economic crisis of neoliberalism epitomized by the Argentine crisis of 2002. What I think is going on today in Latin America is a number of relatively open-ended political, economic, and social trends that I will call the but trend, the pero trends, in the sense I'm going to explain in a minute. And I will just, in 2 minutes, I will enumerate five trends and one corollary that. The first trend is, of course, the end of the so-called commodity boom, which we all know, more or less since 2012, 2013, Latin American economies on average has not been growing. But, and this is the but, it is also that the economy have not fallen out of a cliff, like the economies of Latin America fell in the 1990s or some other economies fell in 2002, 2003. It's true that Venezuela and Brazil have deep economic crisis, but Venezuela is an outlier in many other things in Latin America. So the reality here is of a stagnation, mildly negative or low economic growth, rather than what has been very much the case in Latin America, huge financial crisis and hyperinflation as we have seen in the past. And also the commodity boom is over, what is still historically in a decade, in a period of very low interest rates. Maybe they are going up now, but not so much. So that's the first trend, the end of the commodity boom, but not the economy has not fallen out of a cliff. The second one is, of course, closely related to the previous one, is the end of a period of almost unprecedented rise in standard of living and social transformation in the region, but here again, a new but, not yet at least, massive declines in living standards of the population. Yeah, maybe unemployment is up, maybe some decline in living standards, but not massive decline in living standards. Just to give you an example, in 2001, 2002, in Argentina, more than double, and almost treble, the number of people living under the poverty line. Again, if we leave the case of Venezuela apart, there is nothing like this happening in Latin America. Even in Brazil, the sort of the second worst performing economy in the region, the majority of the people are still better off than they were, say, 5 years ago. The third trend is the end of the so-called pink tide, but again, not the end of the left as a political relevant electoral force. And if we look at the panorama, again, in South America rather than in Latin America, we have, of course, the three main left or left and center projects in the region. We have Argentina that was a quite narrow electoral defeat in 2015. In Brazil, we have to remember the Dilma Rousseff actually won the election in 2014 and was out of office from a process of impeachment. Venezuela, there was a massive parliamentary defeat, but the government is still in office, hanging on. And we have Chile, Uruguay, Bolivia, and Ecuador, who are still left or left of center, I mean, whatever you want to define, are in office. And I guess that the elections in Ecuador that we are going to talk today and Chile later this year will be important to determine the direction of the region. But also we have to remember next year will be elections in Mexico, and perhaps one of the main impact Trump president to Trump's presidency to Latin America will increase the chances of Manuel López Obrador winning the election, fight fire with fire. So this is a third trend. The fourth, again, is the weakening of incumbency advantage has been a characteristic of Latin America for much of the 21st century, but again, not the end of incumbency advantage. Between 2000 and 2012, the sort of favorable economic conditions made governments, the relation of governments or party government, the trend in Latin America. That is not happening anymore. It doesn't mean that incumbents still have significant resources in Latin America. The control of the state in Latin America has been traditionally a massive electoral asset. Maybe this state has not, the state had not as many resources as before, but still have considerable resources. And also the ability of governments to define the rules of the game, electoral and others, are an important advantage. So if we look at the last few elections in Latin America, we have a mixed panorama. In Argentina, they lost. In Nicaragua, it was reelected. Again, it's not clear, it's not the sort of re-election or re-election is not the rule, but still there is no more the sort of massive incumbent advantage that we and the governments enjoyed in the early 2000s. My fifth trend is the limitation of populists, but not the end of populists. Again, another but here. What are the limits of populists? Well, in Latin America, and I don't want to enter here in a debate about what is populist, what is not populist, who is populist and not populist, but let's agree that government that by and large had been characterized consensually as populist has been in office for quite a long time. And I think it's getting more and more difficult, not impossible, but more and more difficult to rule as anti-establishment candidates when you are have become part of the establishment. And of course, also they have less resources to redistribute that many people associate to populists. Not necessarily, but many associate. But again, seeing that this is the end of populists, I don't think so, because many of the drivers of populists in Latin America as were are still very much part of the region. Low trust in institutions, weak political parties, inequality, corruption, a middle class under pressure and alienated from politics, and can go on and on. So I think these five trends, show which each of one I have been trying to qualify, what this is going on, but explain why we don't have in Latin America general change as we have in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000. Why is that? Because politics is a defining characteristic of how these different trends will operate in different countries. And I will close my intervention with a final reflection about how politics operate. In facing this trend, I would argue that neither the left nor the right, or neither the center left or the center right, have a clear narrative and a clear strategy how to address this trend. And let me explain here. In the 1980s, the debt crisis was a clear response from the right that was the neoliberal project. In the 2000s, the crisis of neoliberalism, again, the center left had a clear strategy, sort of anti-neoliberal strategy, etc. Neither these cases, neither is the case here. And why is that? Because I think, by and large, the left in government was too dependent on high commodity prices and didn't promote it. Necessary reform to have a more sustainable economic model, but also there is a crisis of the right or the neoliberal right. Why, and this is more evident, has become more evident over the past year or so with Brexit and the rise of Trump, because there is a fundamental crisis of the liberal political and economic order that have sort of been the dominant political order in the world, if not in Latin America, over the past 10, 20, or 30 years, and particularly in the United States and Europe, and it would be very difficult to reassert this kind of order in terms of the rise of nationalists and right-wing populists and so on and so forth. So both from the left and from the right, there is no clear answer to these trends. Thank you.
Hola, Diana.
Sí.
No sé si te parece, de acuerdo a la presentación que habíamos circulado acá, estaba primero el profesor Paniza, luego Nicolás, luego volvíamos con Andrés allá y terminaba la intervención mía, ¿te parece? Porque es como habíamos circulado eso en la invitación.
Okay. ¿Ir primero con Andrés?
No, el profesor Paniza que ya intervino, Nicolás acá, volvemos a Londres con Andrés y luego termino yo.
Ok, está bien, Sandra. Entonces seguimos, sería Nicolás, Santiago y terminamos con Andrés. Bueno. Ecuador, ¿pueden ver allá la presentación?
Sí, sí, correcto. Aquí estamos.
Listo. So, thanks for, sorry for these technical problems, and then we're gonna continue with Nicolás Acosta from the Pontificia Universidad Católica del Ecuador.
Bueno, trataré de hablar en inglés en este caso. ¿Listo? ¿Comenzamos?
Sí, estamos. Yes.
Okay. So first of all, I want to thank London School of Economics for this kind invitation. I want to say sorry if my English is not as good as it was some time ago, so hope you can understand. I appreciate it. What we have to understand first are what are the challenges ahead for the next government. Before to analyze the proposals of the candidates, we have to be clear what are the challenges ahead for the next government, what economy is going to receive next government, because that's going to bound the possibilities of the candidates offer. So first of all, let's take a look at the GDP growth rate. See, in the last five quarters, the GDP has contracted since the last quarter of the third quarter of 2015. This is due to the fall in the oil price in the oil prices. The growth rates in the last year is pretty dramatic compared to the growth rate in the time before. So you can see from 2011, 2013, the growth rate was above 6%. Now we're in a recession. Next one, please. So what happened with the tax revenue? The tax revenue is also decreasing in the last year. So this is explained basically because the GDP went down, so the economic activity is not is decreasing. What we have to check is the value-added tax called IVA in Ecuador. Even with the increase by 2 percentage points, IVA has decreased in the last year. So this is basically a sign of the deterioration in the economic activity. Next slide, please. What happened with labor force, with employment? Total labor force, or called economically active population in Ecuador, is 5.3 million. Adequate work, that represents people that works at least 40 hours and receive at least the minimum wage, represents 47% of total labor force. That's not the problem. Neither the problem is the unemployment rate, that is 5%. The real problem in Ecuadorian labor force is the underemployment, unpaid work, non-adequate work, no classified work. What is this? This is basically people that work less than 40 hours a week, earn less than a minimum wage, or people that would like to work more hours. That represents 52% of labor force. This means that the half of the population in Ecuador doesn't have a decent job, to say it in some way. Next slide, please. And this is the most important graph in the whole presentation, maybe. This is the public debt as percentage of the GDP. Public debt has increased dramatically in Ecuador in the last 2 years. Nowadays, public debt, according to the Ministry of Finance, or how do you call it in in England, I don't know. But the statistic shows that debt as percentage of the GDP in Ecuador is 39.6%. The ceiling debt in Ecuador is 40% according to the Code of Finance Planning. One could say, well, that's not a, doesn't seem a lot of debt, but to Ecuador is really important. Because external debt has increased in the last years, and this external debt is pretty expensive, and is next government will have to pay this debt until 2022. So debt would be a really concern for the next government. The internal debt is basically explained with the debt that the government has with the social security system. And the external debt is debt in the bond market and with the external creditors. Next slide, please. So how we explain the debt that the government is having now? This is explained basically was highly correlated with the variation in the oil price. When the oil price goes down, the government has to contract debt to maintain the public expenditure. So there is a really high correlation between oil price variation and general government balance. Next slide, please. This is an indicator that we build in the consistency report, macroeconomic consistency report in the Catholic University in Ecuador. This is called the fiscal consistency price. This means nowadays that the oil price that Ecuador is receiving by exporting oil is $40 in average, but the fiscal consistency price is $80. This means that the oil price should be $40 expensive to maintain fiscal policy in the long run in Ecuador. So nowadays we need oil price of more than $40 than it is now. Next slide, please. So this is basically a reality. To visualize this in a better way, let's see what happened last year in the public budget. Last year in 2016, public budget was $24,000 million. Government revenue was only 1,600 millions, and public expenditure was 24,000 millions. This means that the government had a deficit of 7.5 thousand millions of dollars. This means that 31% of public budget was covered by debt. This is dramatic because national budget would be constrained by public debt in the next government. They will have to pay this debt. As I said before, the debt has a short-term obligation that will have to be paid in the future. According to some estimates, approximately 10% of public budget to the public budget should be. I mean that 10% of public budget have to be. We should go to public to pay public debt in the next year. So next government will have to expand 10% to debt service. Next slide, please. So what I focus now is the main concern for the next government is public debt. This is also an indicator that we build in the macroeconomic consistency report that is called the Blanchard indicator. The Blanchard indicator basically measures the sustainability of fiscal policy in the long run. As we see now, according to the Blanchard indicator, the fiscal policy in Ecuador is unsustainable. That means that in the future, Ecuador could not maintain his fiscal policy and probably would do a default. So why I'm worried about public debt? So why I'm focused on this? Why public debt? When public debt is bad? So public debt is bad when the debt doesn't. For instance, for a person, if you buy a house with a credit, probably it's not bad because you will live in that house for many years and then your kids will live in that house, or when you ask for a loan for a master's degree, in the future you will have a better wage and you can pay that debt. In Ecuador, public debt would be a concern since there are many public infrastructure that has overpriced some public debt could be or could go to pay a salary of bureaucracy, and that means that public debt would not pay by themselves. So public debt disappears in the economy, it doesn't come back to the economy. For instance, we would like to expect that public debt implies that we have a better infrastructure. This infrastructure means that we're producing more, we're having more taxes, and those taxes are paying the debt. But this is not what we see now in Ecuador for now. See, tax revenue is decreasing. We would expect that with the big public expenditure we had years ago, tax revenue should increase now. This means that the debt is paying by itself, but this is not what happens now in Ecuador. So next slide, please. So now let's focus on the economic and social proposal of the candidates. Okay, the first the big proposal of the candidates is to eliminate taxes, such as capital living tax, here in Ecuador called Impuesto a la Salida de Divisas, prepaid income tax, in Ecuador is Impuesto Anticipado a la Renta, tariff aranceles. Basically, the whole candidates are carrying these proposals. I'm really surprised that the whole candidates ask to eliminate taxes. Why they don't say we have to reduce taxes? Why to eliminate? We're in the same game that the government did some years ago. So we put this tax, you tax some activity, but why? For the same reason, the other candidates are saying you have to eliminate taxes. I believe that we first have to do a good analysis or have to really do some economic investigation to analyze if we really have to eliminate taxes. It sounds like a political marketing to eliminate taxes, but we first have to see if these taxes are not bad or, I don't know. For instance, capital living tax, from my point of view, I believe that it's too high, but I don't support that we have to eliminate this tax. See, when the capital living tax, Impuesto a las Divisas, was 0.5%, well, it wasn't bad, but now it's 5%, probably is bad. Some other candidates, including the government, the Alianza País candidate, said that it's going to reduce the value-added tax that it was raised the last April since the Ecuadorian earthquake. This was a promise of the government that this increase in tax was only going to be for a year. But we have to see what happens next if we reduce this tax. Other candidates, well, in this presentation, I would like to avoid the candidate's name for being respectful. Some other candidates proposed really, I say, I don't want to say something that I don't want. Tax holidays, for instance, the tax holidays, we first have to know what really means a tax holiday. Tax holiday means that if some investment comes to Ecuador, they will not pay income tax. We have to check first what the economic literature says about tax holidays. Tax holidays are very criticized in the economic literature because tax holidays have bad incentives to the operators, to the people that is producing now in Ecuador. For instance, let's think in a hotel. A hotel that is now operating in Ecuador has to pay income tax. But if some new hotel comes to Ecuador, they will not pay income tax. So this is introduced a really unbalanced competition between the new investment and the old investment. The new investment will not pay tax, and the old investment is going to pay taxes. And in some way, the one that doesn't pay tax could reduce his cost and be more competitive than the other. So that's not what we would like to expect. Also, tax holidays are good to tax evasion. For instance, since these the entrepreneur or the firm that does not pay taxes, this firm could transfer his cost to other firms that does pay taxes. So this could this tax evasion.
Sí,
this is Anita. Yeah, perfect. So as I said, tax holiday we have to really analyze if tax holidays are good or bad. So economic literature says that tax holidays have some big troubles, like I mentioned before, tax evasion and unfair competition. The candidates also focus on trade agreements that to generate employment. The last agreement that Ecuador signed was with the European Union, so some candidates offered to sign trade agreement with the Asia-Pacific countries and with the United States. They also recognize that Ecuador needs to increase foreign direct investments and increase national private investment through public and private partnerships. And every single candidate mentioned something new in these elections, that is entrepreneurship development programs.
3 minutes to finish. 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. They also want to create 1 million of jobs in 4 years. That sounds very generous, since the economic activity in Ecuador is really bad. So to generate 1,000 million in 4 years, GDP has to grow over 8% in average per year, which seems really tough to the conditions nowadays, and also to improve competitiveness. And this is hard because Ecuadorian is a dollarized economy that cannot depreciate the money. So improve competitiveness seems hard. Basically, to improve competitiveness, we have to develop technology and reduce its cost. And this is a really, this is introduce foreign bank competition to reduce interest rate. I don't really understand this proposal. If this was true, to introduce more competition in banking sector doesn't reduce interest rate. Banks in come to Ecuador don't want to come to Ecuador because the return on equity indicator is lower in Ecuador. It's 5%, and in Peru and Colombia is 15%. So I don't see why more actors imply a lower interest rate. Also, the candidates want to return to farm, recognizing that Ecuador is a primary country. In the social proposals to end, the candidates propose to increase the conditional transfer called BDH, Bono de Desarrollo Humano. This doesn't seem good, because a better proposal would be that instead of increase the conditional transfer, why don't you think in an incentive to firms to contract people in these conditions? For people living in poor, would be better to have a job rather than have a conditional transfer. So why not to think in a labor incentive? So incentive to firms to contract people living in poor. Some proposals that are really optimistic, like housing for everyone, university for everyone, eliminate child undernutrition. That is a really concern in Ecuador. Nowadays, child undernutrition is 24%, and has only reduced 1.7% in the last 8 years. So it's really a concern. So eliminate child undernutrition in 4 years sounds really hard to achieve. And free electricity for poor people, and pay social and security, pay the debt to social security system that is really high. The candidates want to pay the debt to social security system. The government some years ago paid 40% of pension system retired. Nowadays the government does not pay. That means that in 40 years the retired people...
We are running out of time. If you
okay,
one more
okay.
minute.
Okay, so that's it. What to do first in the next years for the next government? They have to set out the rules for the economic activity. What is the role of the government? What is the role for the government? Initial tax reform for 4 years, what I suggest, make a fiscal adjustment, reduce public expenditure, sincere public debt data, because public debt data in Ecuador doesn't include lending operations to central bank, debt to social security system, and pre-sale oil, renegotiate public debt, and define the role of central bank. And that's basically all. I hope you can understood what I said.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now would be the turn of Nicolás Acosta, pardon, Santiago Basabi, implications and feasibility of Candia's proposal around sociopolitical reform, constitutional reform, laws, enactment, derogation. Thank you.
Gracias, Francisco y Andrés y la gente que está allá. Yo como voy a hablar a mi pueblo votante del día domingo, y quiero que me entiendan bien cómo votar, les voy a hablar en español. Yo quería presentar ahora mismo, ojalá podamos resolver esto, algunos productos de la página web Vitrina Electoral que la hemos organizado en la Maestría de Política Comparada de Flaxo y las estudiantes, sobre todo los y las estudiantes fundamentalmente, pero hasta que podamos arreglar creo que va a demorar un poco. Básicamente lo que nosotros hicimos es ubicar a los candidatos presidenciables en diferentes dimensiones, en la dimensión económica en primera instancia, colocando los candidatos que van desde la izquierda extrema, que sería entendida como un modelo económico donde hay mucha intervención del Estado, poco espacio para la acción, para el sector privado, y quería hasta una extrema derecha donde el Estado prácticamente desaparece en todas sus funciones, una visión más libertaria si ustedes quieren. A partir de esa división que hicimos, y las personas que si tienen un teléfono o una computadora quizás me pueden seguir, la página es www.vitrinaelectoral.com. Si ustedes están en la página, y con esto ya voy a volver enseguida, y si ustedes están en la página, sale el profesor Simón Pachano en un video ilustrativo inicialmente, y luego se van a la parte de arriba donde dice cómo piensan los presidenciables y ahí se le da clic. Van a continuar. Ahí la primera dimensión que aparece es la dimensión, no salió todavía, es la dimensión económica. Y en la dimensión económica tenemos del 5.5, que sería como el centro de la dimensión, girado hacia la izquierda Lenín Moreno y el resto de candidatos más corridos hacia el centro derecha, estando el señor Moncayo casi en la mitad y mucho más a la derecha, a Cintia Viteri y el señor Guillermo Lasso, refiriéndome básicamente a los cuatro que tendrían más opciones electorales, al menos de momento. Luego tenemos una dimensión política donde analizamos nuevamente, ya voy a luego si es que hay un poco de tiempo voy a referirme a la metodología que utilizamos, donde revisamos cómo piensan los políticos, los candidatos presidenciales en la relación entre sociedad y Estado, cuántas libertades mayores o menores deberían tener los ciudadanos, y acá a la extrema izquierda está mucho más pegado, mucho más cercano el candidato Moreno, y el resto nuevamente siguiendo ese mismo parámetro del centro hacia la derecha con algunos más inclinados. Luego tenemos una dimensión donde vinculamos lo económico y lo político para sacar un índex que sigue las condiciones que he planteado hace un momento. Y luego una última dimensión que es muy interesante en América Latina, que es la dimensión de valores. En general solemos creer, me parece equivocadamente, que ser una persona liberal en términos económicos implica ser conservador en términos de valores, o que ser muy estatista en términos económicos implica ser muy abierto en términos de valores, y eso no necesariamente se da así. Entonces, en esta diapositiva tenemos la dimensión de valores, donde de la mitad hacia abajo, es decir, una visión más aperturista, está el candidato Moncayo y el candidato Moreno, y más hacia arriba Lasso y Viteri. Y finalmente tenemos una interacción ya de la dimensión económico-política versus la de valores. Y tenemos cuatro cuadrantes, un cuadrante superior derecho que sería el candidato aperturista en lo económico y conservador en valores, donde estaría Cintia Viteri y donde estaría el señor Lasso, un candidato más estatista y un poco más liberal en valores, que estaría el señor Moreno, y un candidato corrido ligeramente hacia el centro derecho en lo económico y también un poco hacia lo liberal en valores, que sería el general Moncayo. Es interesante estos cuadrantes porque hasta hace poco el presidente Correa se ubica mejor en el cuadrante que ahora está vacío, que sería de un estatismo conservador, es decir, en lo económico muy orientado hacia el Estado, pero en el tema de valores muy conservador. Y finalmente, y aquí me voy a detener ya para pasar al otro tema, hicimos una dimensión donde preguntamos, hicimos las preguntas sobre la posibilidad de mantener o cambiar las políticas públicas de los candidatos. Y ahí, muy cerca del uno, que es mantener estables las políticas públicas del candidato Moreno, más arriba, es decir, con mayor intención de cambio, el señor Moncayo, y finalmente con una intención de variar las políticas públicas de forma más drástica, la señora Viteri y el candidato Lazo. Y en este punto es donde me quiero detener un poquito para discutir algunas cuestiones interesantes sobre esta dimensión de mantenimiento o cambio de políticas públicas, y me refiero, por ejemplo, a mantener o no el CENESIT. Mientras Lenín Moreno dirá el CENESIT tiene que mantenerse, el señor Moncayo dirá hay que hacer algunos cambios importantes, mientras que Cintia Viteri y Guillermo Lazo dice hay que desaparecerlo. A eso me refiero, a la dimensión de cambio, estabilidad. Y quiero poner simplemente dos escenarios que podrían darse, y esto es ex post de las elecciones para no entrar en la discusión de pronósticos de quiénes podrían ser los que pasen a la segunda vuelta, si es que hay segunda vuelta o no. Y el primer escenario es el de Moreno presidente. Moreno presidente en primera vuelta o en segunda vuelta. Esto en la dimensión de políticas públicas implicaría una estabilidad, no mayores cambios en ninguno de los campos, salvo algunas cosas no tan medulares a la política ni a la economía, que habría variación. Esto implicaría un primer resultado, un primer producto, que es una tensión con la legislatura. Si hacemos una muy por encima aproximación de los resultados electorales respecto a la nueva conformación de la legislatura, se podría esperar que haya un reflejo de lo que se distribuya en términos de votos para presidentes en la legislatura. En otros términos, tendríamos una asamblea de aproximadamente 30-35% de asientos de la hora oficialismo Alianza País. Algunas personas más optimistas con Alianza País pensarían que es un poco más, quizás por el tema de las reglas electorales, un porcentaje de 20 aproximadamente, todo esto de creo, algo parecido del Partido Social Cristiano, un poco hacia abajo, 15%, 12% el general Moncayo, más sus aliados, que como ustedes saben, en algunas provincias la izquierda democrática no tiene candidatos, sino que va en alianza con la Unidad Popular o con Pachacútic, y luego unos pocos espacios para partidos que tendrán una representación, pero muy minoritaria. Me refiero a FE, por ejemplo, el anterior PRE, eventualmente Concertación Nacional de César Montúfar, eventualmente algún asiento de Sociedad Patriótica. Esta mayor dispersión de fuerzas en la legislatura, no observada en los últimos años, podría generar una tensión importante respecto del presidente de la República. En el caso, insisto, en el primer escenario, que sea el señor Moreno. Una tensión porque de un lado habría la intencionalidad de mantener las políticas públicas tal cual se han manejado hasta el momento, y por el otro lado una presión no solo de los actores, sino por cumplir sus plataformas electorales, los legislativos, por generar un cambio. Y eso, insisto, podría generar un fuerte cruce entre ejecutivo y legislativo que no se había visto en el país hace mucho tiempo. Y ahí me parece que un elemento fundamental para resolver, si es que se puede resolver esta tensión, va a ser quién maneje la política desde el Ejecutivo. Hasta ahora el ministro de la política en el país no ha sido tan importante, porque con una mayoría tan aplastante de Alianza País, la aprobación de la agenda de gobierno fluía con muchísima facilidad. Esto no pasaría. Y ahí, insisto, habría un actor fundamental que sería el que maneje la política del gobierno del presidente Moreno, pensando en esa posibilidad. Una segunda opción, un segundo escenario que podría resolver esto, es que Moreno cambie diametralmente su estrategia política al momento de llegar. Específicamente me refiero a que abra el escenario político a un gobierno de coalición que no necesariamente implique solamente Alianza País, sino que pueda llamar a diferentes actores, a diferentes sectores, incluso algunos que ahora mismo se han posicionado en la oposición, de cara a generar una mayor estabilidad y una mayor fluidez en el gobierno. Ese podría ser un escenario ideal con costos, evidentemente.
Tres minutos.
Como podría ser uno de ellos, la tensión con el actual presidente de la República, y rememorar en alguna medida con las distancias la relación entre el presidente Roldós y Assad Bucaram. Y finalmente, la posibilidad de la muerte cruzada, que siempre está presente de acuerdo a nuestra normativa constitucional, con lo que el presidente Moreno se podría quedar por varios meses legislando solo bajo decretos. Y el segundo escenario, este voy a ir más rápido por el tiempo, es que alguno de la oposición gane, el señor Lasso, la señora Viteri o el señor Moncayo. Habría una necesidad, por tanto, de cambios más o menos radicales respecto a las políticas públicas. La posibilidad más cierta de un gobierno de coalición entre ejecutivo y legislativo, porque las fuerzas en la legislatura estarían medianamente cercanas, al menos al inicio, exceptuando Alianza País, evidentemente, y esto podría facilitar o viabilizar la reforma o la derogatoria de algunas leyes claves, como la Ley Orgánica de Comunicación, por ejemplo. Sin embargo, hay otros temas más de fondo, como eliminar el Consejo de Participación Ciudadana, por ejemplo, que es una de las propuestas del señor Lasso, que implicarían reformas mucho más profundas, y esto nos llevaría a una reforma parcial de la Constitución, con todo el componente legal normativo que se debe seguir de cara a posibilitar esto. Esta ya sería una cuestión de una negociación mucho más fuerte, de mayor alcance, y donde entraría a jugar un actor clave, decisivo en esto que es la Corte Constitucional. Y en ese punto de la Corte Constitucional, y ahí me voy a detener porque no tengo más tiempo, ahí se deberá discutir cuál va a ser el papel de esa Corte una vez que el gobierno del presidente Correa termine, si mantiene la línea política que ha mantenido hasta la fecha, o si eventualmente podría girar y viabilizar un proceso de reformas constitucionales como las que, me parece, en muchos de los temas que el señor Lasso, que la señora Viteri y también el general Moncayo han propuesto, va a ser indispensable llegar a una reforma por esa vía y no simplemente por una derogatoria de norma. Con esto entonces está planteado el primer escenario con Moreno, ganador primera segunda vuelta, el segundo con cualquier opositor ganador.
Para finalizar.
Y con esto termino. Gracias.
Buenas noches y gracias por la invitación. I was asked to speak in Spanish and in English and present prepare my presentation in English. So, unlike Basabe, I'm going to stick to the rules and present in English as agreed. But we can come back to English and Spanish in the question and answer, right? Okay. So I wanted to start thanking the LSE Student Society, Ecuadorian Student Society, the colleagues at Flaxo and other colleagues and friends present that I can see in the screen. So greetings there. I want to try to make a very concise presentation in 4 slides to keep it within time. And what I will be speaking about is basically 2 things. Looking at the 2017 election, I get this sense that we are witnessing a very important change in what has been the end of an unprecedented period in contemporary Ecuadorian history in terms of the magnitude of the bonanza, the oil boom, the ability to have large partisan majorities, a fairly decisive government in making policy. But at the on the other hand, the end of the bonanza, which will mean the end of this opportunity, what I will argue and show in my slides, what is possibly a collection of wasted opportunities, and therefore there's very little legacy to claim, both in economic terms, but most importantly, in political terms. So in a way, it's an interesting period because we will see a lot of change from a fairly large period of political hegemony, going back to the same partidocracia, possibly from where this revolution started over 10 years ago. And that in itself is an irony. Perhaps answering to Francisco's initial comments in terms of what we have not yet, what we have not seen, sort of the crisis, the boom, the crisis, and stability, I would add not yet. We have not yet seen the magnitude of the crisis that is about to, or that is quite likely to erupt. So the first slide, I will first explain how we are coming to the end of what could be called a period of rentier nationalism. Essentially, this combination of fairly strong governments with a large electoral mandate to make a series of reforms, who have been empowered by a fairly large commodity boom, high oil prices, and as I explained, large partisan majorities. This should have been a fairly interesting and unique opportunity to start making changes. There is one part that we can observe in terms of how the government has in fact centralized quite a lot of policy making in both the way it manages the budget, in way it has centralized the budget, it has increased prerogatives in its policy making ability. But it would have been expected that this type of bonanza would have created a series of movement incentives in the economy to grow and expand and diversify, and we're not seeing this. The first chart that I'm showing is the evolution of expenditures and total revenues and total expenditures at the subnational level. This is city government compared to oil exports. And what we can see is that there's a growing sense of, there's a growing rate of transfers from the central to municipal governments. And this happens despite the gradual reduction in oil exports. So if you look at the end of the chart, on the first chart towards 2014-15, we will see that there's a growing deficit that is not being addressed or sustained. And the next chart corroborates this point because in the context of an oil bonanza, there are very few incentives to increase productivity, raise more taxes, diversify production, and so on and so forth. The lower chart shows a sample of the low fiscal efforts coming from municipal governments. There's very little taxation collected at municipal level. So there's very as I will argue, there's very little room to make adjustments. If during the period of hegemony there was very little reforms made, it will be even more difficult to make these ideal reforms that Nicolas usefully showed when we hit a time of crisis. My second point is that this apparent growth in bonanza would have triggered or would have led a significant incumbency advantage, as Francisco usefully pointed out at the beginning. By this we mean that if the government has oil revenues, it has the ability to control in a somewhat discretionary way, would have been possible to expand the growth and the rootedness of the political party into different layers of government. This is certainly the case at the national level, where we have seen that the government party obtained a majority coalition after 2009 and a single party majority after 2013. But when we start looking at the subnational level, the image, the landscape we have is more sobering. The chart shows the breakdown of mayoral elections in Ecuador in 2009 and 2014 municipal elections. Of a total of 2021 mayors, only 63 mayors belonged to the government party in 2009, and this was reduced to 43 government mayors in 2014. If we look at the, and most of them are in smaller cities, cities lower than 50,000 inhabitants. So if we look at cities, bigger cities in statistical terms, bigger than 50,000 people. We can think, for example, of Balsar, La Troncal, Pedernales. These are relatively small villages, but this is my threshold, 50,000 inhabitants. We see that the government only has about 9% of its mayors in those cities, which means that most of its political capital comes from smaller cities. That's my point. When we look at re-election rates, which would be a way to test incumbency advantage, that is, to what extent the government has used up all the oil revenues to boost and strengthen and consolidate its political strength in the territory, the picture that we see is quite bleak. In general, the re-election rate for mayors is quite low, about 32%, 71 mayors re-elected in 2009, and this drops to 49 mayors in 2014. So this the drop is from one in third mayors that were re-elected to one in five. And it is quite a dramatic drop. When we look at the government mayors, the ability of the government to support and encourage municipal re-elections is even lower. It goes from 21 mayors in 2009 to 27 mayors in 2014. This is quite shocking, considering that in this period of time between 2009 and 2014, the government invested quite a lot in municipal transfers. In fact, the share of transfers from central to municipal governments doubled in this five-year period. Yet the re-election rate of mayors remains essentially the same. And this is what I meant by a wasted opportunity to increase its political capital. When we look at the number of mayors re-elected in larger cities, the picture is even bleak. Only four mayors, the government party only re-elected four mayors in four of the 56 larger cities, and it did the same in 2014, which means that the presence, the political influence of the government party at the subnational level is quite weak. And this is likely to become magnified or reflect itself in the absence of a strong party leader. When the competition goes to a different, it will be fragmented, as I can show in my next slide. So the second part of my talk, I'm going to focus on the political realignments and policy making implications of this coming election, regardless of who comes into power. The first point is that we are likely to observe a return to political fragmentation. There's likely to be, as we already see from the opinion ratings, quite a lot of fragmentation in terms of candidate likely share of the vote. As Santiago Basabe already anticipated, there would be a fragmented Congress with some relatively small pluralities between 30% and 40% in the case of the largest party, assuming we will have no blatant fraud, electoral fraud, which is something that we can go back and talk during the Q&A. But there will be fragmentation and regionalization. But as it was shown in a previous presentation, this is not necessarily polarization, which is potentially a good thing. The government party will be faced, again, whoever wins the election will be faced with the difficult decision of having to push through unpopular adjustment reforms, fiscal reforms, debt management, tax collection, diversifying of the economy, etc., with multiple parties who are not willing to collaborate. And I think we know a thing or two about how the story goes when the president needs to bargain with multiple parties that are not willing to collaborate. This will make reforms unlikely to pass, or more precisely, there will be a status quo bias, which is not necessarily a bad thing when it comes to big policies like dollarization. There seems to be a de facto consensus on the things that do work, but it's going to be difficult to pass any form of reforms unless there's some serious bargaining around how to go about assembling different coalition partners. This is going to be quite difficult because the government will be facing a situation of economic austerity. And as the 2000 crisis reminds us, it's very difficult to pass reforms when you don't have congressional majorities and when you don't have money in the coffers to offer to different parties. The picture is likely to be replicated at the and perhaps expanded when we look, when we consider the subnational arena. There'll be increased subnational conflict, I anticipate, and quite a lot of opposition at the street level. The next question is, would this political fragmentation, unlike the period of the Correa administration, would this lead to more checks and balances and greater oversight? I think the answer is mixed. On the one hand, yes, there will be more veto players participating in the policy making, and there will be more incentives to bargain across. But on the other hand, there will be what I called a return or a resilience of the presidential temptation. That is, traditionally, Ecuadorian presidents have always had this ambition, this wish to become powerful in terms of policy making abilities. And the Correa administration has certainly achieved quite a lot of that. With a mix of oil reform, oil money and constitutional reforms and sort of the political movement that brought this government into power, the president has effectively become a powerful agenda setter. Whether you look at it in terms of its ability to appoint cabinets, with its ability to manage budgets discretionarily or in different ways, its ability to veto critical legislation and initiate a different legislation, its ability to directly or indirectly control appoint oversight authorities, including the Electoral Tribunal, the General Controller, the Attorney General. And one of the things that we saw happen is the adoption of a fairly restrictive communications law, which in some terms became equivalent to gagging rules to curtail freedom of press. These are prerogatives, for the most part, that are embedded in the Constitution, and they will require a qualified majority, at least a two-thirds majority, to change, or a popular referendum, a popular mobilization and consensus to change these things through a plebiscite. Neither of these conditions are present now. The condition that made the 2008 constitution possible are not present. There are no partisan majorities, and the government lacks the momentum. I would be surprised if there is a momentum towards adopting greater reforms. This point, and I'll finish with this, to a paradox, because on the one hand, there would be a very difficult constitution to change, yet presidents, whoever comes into power, may be tempted to use this powerful toolbox to get their agendas passed regardless, with less consultation, with less inclusion, with more decree power, with more veto power, et cetera, et cetera, because the toolbox, as I said here, may become handy for any weak president to navigate and push through difficult reforms through a fairly fragmented legislature. So in an ironic way, this may be an interesting return to what was there before the revolution. Thank you.